Hi everyone, I'm Joop, the co-founder and CEO of Remote, where we are reimagining how the world works and lives. And this is Remote Talks, the show where we interview the top minds in remote work and global employment. This week, CodeSignal CEO Tigran Sloyan joins the show to discuss ways to remove bias from interview processes and how to measure performance of talent teams more effectively. I hope you'll enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed talking to Tigran. Welcome to Remote Talks. Co-founder and CEO of CodeSignal. For those of us that don't know what it is, could you tell us?
Absolutely. Hey, Joop, thanks a lot for having me. CodeSignal is a tech company based in Silicon Valley, but remote first, which is going to be part of the talk today. So what we do is we help companies go beyond resumes in technical recruiting by really enabling to identify talent directly. Instead of relying on proxies such as your resume, like where you went to school or where you've worked before.
And so how do you do this? Like, how do you go beyond resumes?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. So what we do is, think of it like a flight simulator, right? So when you're a pilot and people are trying to understand, are you ready to get on a real plane? They have a whole simulation built for you. You get into it and you do everything that needs to be done, from takeoff to landing to managing very difficult situations where one of your engine blows and everything else in between, right? So similar concept here for software developers specifically. We've built a flight simulator that can simulate everything from building a front-end widget to making database queries to talking to APIs, et cetera, et cetera. And as such, we're able to measure ability directly by simulating all of those scenarios and producing an automated score that essentially allows companies to rely on very direct and unbiased measure of ability.
And so this is to go beyond the traditional whiteboard interview that is notorious in most of Silicon Valley.
Yeah, so it's a combination, right? So the biggest problem that we're solving is at the very top of the funnel. What ends up happening is you just don't have enough interviewers to even do the whiteboard interview, right? Because especially in the world where people are starting to open up and hire more remotely, you literally get thousands and thousands of applications, even as a small startup. I'm not even talking about the large companies. And when you have such an insane volume, how are you ever going to be talking to even half of those candidates? So what ends up happening is before you even get to the whiteboard interview, like more than 90% of candidates are already cut just based on what their paper resume said. And then you get to the notorious whiteboard interviews or, writing code in a Google Doc or something like this, which is, again, a very poor representation of what somebody can truly do. Yeah. So it's a combination, but I've always seen the biggest pain point to be at the top of the funnel rather than later on, even though later on has been just as broken.
Very interesting. And so what I'm curious about is like, because I remember reading about interviewing engineers and, this was pre-COVID, and one of the pieces of advice that was given was like, give everybody a FSBUS test, which is this incredibly simple programming exercise that if you have programmed anything at all, you should be able to do this, especially if it's in a language that you're applying to a company on. So how is that distribution that you see? You say you have thousands of applicants. Do you find that like, there's only a small fraction that actually goes into more complicated exercises, or how does it look for you today?
Yeah, there is some good advice in giving people something like a FSBUS, but obviously that's outdated in the sense that like everybody knows FSBUS these days. So even if I don't know how to program at all, it was from the co-founder of Stack Overflow or someone like that, right? Who said, hey, we just give everybody FSBUS and then now every, freshman learns what FSBUS is and can write that up without even understanding what it is. Yeah. But I think the core concept behind it, which is like when you're starting to evaluate a candidate, don't just jump straight into, okay, like you're in a flight simulator situation, your co-pilot is having a heart attack, somebody's screaming from the back, it's a very complex situation. Yeah. Like, let's start off from, do you even know where the controls are, right? Yeah. Or can you do like a simple takeoff where nothing is wrong Because if they can't do that, what's the point of going into this very in-depth evaluation? And I think that's kind of the primary notion, right? And we advise that a lot, is that like when you're starting to evaluate someone, start from some core basic principles, right? If they can't do that, you're just wasting both your time as well as the candidate's time, because I mean, they would like to understand if there is any promise to this from the get-go, instead of spending hours and hours and then like, yeah, you're just completely not qualified for this role.
And so if an employer starts to work with you, do you advise them, well, you know, every engineer that applies to your company, just get them started on CodeSignal and like you go from there, or should they use your product in a later stage of like the hiring funnel?
Yeah, the primary usage, the most value add usage tends to be at the very top of the funnel, but it carries forward all the way to like an on-site interview and doing better remote pair programming interviews. But it starts at the very top of the funnel, where instead of relying on resumes, you give people opportunity. And again, the assessment itself doesn't end up being the only indicator, because one thing that people don't realize is not just like your ability at the given moment in time, is like what opportunities have you had to get that skill set, right? Because again, going back to the flight simulator analogy, it's one thing that I like can do this. It's another thing is like, am I like a 20 years experienced pilot, or have I just graduated from the academy, right? Because what most employers want to hire for is potential. Like, where are you going to be a year, two or three from now, not where you are today? So when you're considering someone's ability, you actually, and that's why it doesn't say, you know, destroy the resume or like throw away the resume. It says go beyond it. Meaning you have to understand, okay, this is the training, the opportunities you've had, and this is the skill level that you have right now. The combination of the two data points actually gives you a powerful insight into where would this person be a year, two or three from now if you were to bring them on board.
So is this a way for companies to like fight biases in hiring practices?
Definitely. When people ask me what are the main reasons companies work with you guys, the one of the three is to reduce bias, because humans are incredibly biased, right? Like all of us are. There's no, we're a pattern matching device, essentially, our brains are. So whichever way you grew up, whatever you've sort of got accustomed to, even if there's zero pattern, there is just like some weird underlying reason why society happens to be that way, you turn it into a pattern and you make it a rule in your head, right? Like if X then Y, even though there might be zero correlation between X and Y. So all of us are biased. And what happens when humans are the primary kind of deciding elements in this hiring process is, starting from the resume, you tend to filter out those who didn't go to a school you recognize, didn't work at a company that you recognize, or don't fit the sort of standard profile that you've identified as a pattern of people working at the company. Yeah. So you end up hiring more of the same. But it gets worse when it gets to the interview, actually, because once it gets to the interview, I mean, every interviewer would do, even if they're trained, right? Like if they're not trained, then it's a disaster. But even if they're trained, they would go on the interview, and depending on if I like you, if you kind of look like me, talk like me, I would be more inclined to kind of give you a hand as you're answering my questions. Like I'll give you one hint here, one hint there. I will help guide you through the rest of it. So even without like intentionally meaning it, you end up just giving a little bit more guidance, a little bit more help to some of your candidates and not others. And then you look back, you're like, oh, wow, we have a diversity problem. I'm like, yeah, of course you do, because you have this very biased selection process, starting from that very first touch point of looking at the resume all the way down to those on-site interviews and debriefs.
And so, I mean, I'm curious, especially because you're in this business, what do you advise companies? Like you obviously have a tool which allows for like more objective, you know, assessment of skills, but you also say, well, you know, you still want to look at the resume because you want to, you know, you want to hire someone for potential. So how do you avoid, or how do you combat at least a bit that bias that everybody has?
Yeah. It's, I don't know if you've ever heard this analogy, the the elephant and the writer, but there is this concept of people comparing the human brain to an elephant and a writer. And the idea that like your brain kind of in many ways is like an elephant with a writer on it, where the elephant is your the more like the irrational, the emotional, the kind of the biased brain, right, that has certain judgments that just kind of follows a certain path without knowing why it's going there. And then the writer is your rational mind, the one that tries to kind of make very careful, calculated decisions and look at facts instead of just being like, I feel this way because I have this weird bias about it. So if you think about the elephant and the writer, the whole concept behind it is that like, if the elephant decides to go a certain way, once it's down a certain path, you just can't turn it back. You're just kind of stuck on that path, even though your rational mind might realize like, what are we doing here, right? We're just completely gone down the wrong path. It's really difficult to change. However, what the rational mind can do is set the right direction from the get-go, so the elephant doesn't get distracted and then there's no way back. Now, if you think about hiring and recruiting, having a data-driven piece of information early on, right? So imagine starting not with the resume, but starting with objective assessment data. So like if I bring you a candidate, first I show you, if I showed you the resume and you don't like the resume, guess what happens? Your elephant starts going down the wrong path, right? It instantly goes like, ooh, look at that resume, and just chooses down a path of like, nope, we don't like this person. And it's really hard to change that path because you're already leaning a certain direction and your elephant is hard to turn back. Now flip the equation. If I showed you no resume in the beginning and I showed you someone who's like done really well, highly skilled, showed a lot of ability, you're like, wow, who is this person? I'd like to talk to them. Then if we overlay the resume on top of it, you're like, oh, wow, this is, you know, they really haven't had that many opportunities and they're this good. Now you're already, your elephant is facing in the right direction. So you're way more likely to give the person a fair shot instead of walking down a path of no return.
Yeah. That's very interesting. How has this been in the, in the past year with COVID? Has this changed how many companies work with you, how companies think about this? Because one thing that we see from our side is that, you know, there's a enormous amount of organizations going from, well, we hire from within our neighborhoods to now we hire from everywhere. Right. And once you start hiring from everywhere, you actually come across a lot more diverse applicants because, you know, now it's not just people, you know, in the neighborhood of San Francisco that happen to be able to live there or already live there. It's now literally from all corners of the world. And so how has that, has it changed things for you in the past year?
Absolutely. So the first thing that that brings is actually a higher volume of applicants that's just impossible to handle manually.
Right? Yeah, we see so this as well.
The first realization is like, oh, we used to have 100, now we have 1,000. How do we ever make sense of this? The second piece is, as you mentioned, is like a lot more diverse candidates and a lot more diverse backgrounds, because it's no longer like if you haven't worked at one of the top tech startups or at least a VC-backed startup in Silicon Valley, I mean, it could even be reasonable to be like, why, right? Every door you knock on, there is a well-funded startup like right there. How come no one has come to discover you? It still happens a lot in the Bay Area, but it's less likely. When you go outside, I mean, nothing, you don't recognize anything on the resumes. There is nothing really there. And there is no particular reason. There is nothing you can say like, oh, wow, how come? Because there are no startups behind every door, and there are no well-known universities either, right? So it's a very much expected that outside of Silicon Valley, resumes aren't going to be telling you anything. They're not going to have any of the common patterns that recruiters look for. So in this way, it's been great, I think. The other piece of it is going beyond resumes also to give people more opportunity, right? Because like, opportunity has been locked away in these tech hubs, and remote work truly unlocks this ability to say, no matter where you are, right, if you're qualified and if you have the ability, you should have the opportunity to do what you love at a really great company. And that hasn't been the case so far. So when it comes to going beyond resumes, it's not just about being able to measure ability. It's also about being able to give people opportunity who might not be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, no, I love that. It's the mission of our company is to bring.
There you go. I promise I didn't know it.
No, yes, it aligns very much like how I think about the world. Like, and honestly, it's one of my favorite things over this, just to see more of the world, right? Like, and not just by being there. I think a large part of seeing much of the world is like meeting people that live in very different places, in very different cultures, and have lived very different lives than you. I think that's a really nice thing to a really nice bonus of just hiring internationally. So I absolutely love that. And so the Code Signal team, you say you're San Francisco company. Are you now distributed all over the world, or what is the status of that?
Yeah, so we've always had locations in a few places. We've always had some remote employees, but I've always had the nagging feeling that, you know, the coexistence approach of like where some members are in an office, others are fully remote, creates this weird situation where some people know more, some people have more context about the company, those that are usually in person, some have kind of stronger relationships, again, because they are based in person versus others. It's like two different companies, right?
Yeah.
Almost. So I've always wanted to actually start being remote first, where we think about everything from a remote perspective. And then sure, if some people have the opportunity to meet in person, that's a bonus, but you shouldn't sort of build processes and do things with the assumption that you're going to be seeing people in person on a very frequent basis. When COVID happened, we were like, this is it, you know, this is the great opportunity to become remote first and do everything from a remote first perspective. So it's been a fun transition. And I've kind of like, when you're building a product, right? I always say that no product manager can build a great product if they can't use it themselves. I think it's the same for the culture, right? Mm. If you're not remote yourself, trying to design a remote first culture for your team, it's, you just don't know the pains, right? Like, you can't empathize enough with what's going on. And I've been feeling it myself, and it's really allowed to kind of change things from being more asynchronous in communication to like writing more things down. There's so many things that you're like, oh, wow. Yeah. Usually I would just overhear somebody in the kitchen talking about this stuff. Right. And it would kind of give us context. Now there is no kitchen.
Yeah.
So there is nothing to overhear about. And things have to be very much explicit and written down and asynchronous in communication. So it's been an interesting transition, but one that has allowed a lot of our original remote team members to feel a lot more included and a lot more on an even playing field.
Did you cancel the lease of the office?
We tried. I think we just signed the sublease. So it took like 8 months or something to sign the sublease.
Oh, very good. And so how do you deal with time zones? Because I assume now you have people in multiple time zones where previously maybe that was more restricted.
Yeah, so we have people all over the world and time zone is tricky. I think the asynchronous communication piece is core, like trying to avoid meetings as much as possible and like write things down, talk in public channels in Slack, right?
Avoid. Yeah.
One of the metrics we tend to measure on a weekly and monthly basis is like what percentage of our communication is happening in private versus public channels, which is something Slack shares. And I've been making a deliberate push to like, let's talk about stuff in public channels, because it's the same effect as the overhearing in the kitchen, right? So because in a real office, you don't talk to people, you know, in their ear or take them outside. You talk to them just like you do in a direct message.
Yeah.
And people who are around hear it. And if they're interested, they will join you. So public channels, I feel like in many ways have the same effect. But people have a somewhat of a bias of like, hey, I don't want to bother other people by just kind of bringing this conversation to a public channel. Mm-hmm. But they forget that, again, in a real world environment, that's exactly what you do, right? So like you turn around, talk to somebody, and there's a bunch of people around you. If they don't want to hear you, they'll just put their music in their headphones on louder and be done with it. But if they do, they would do the opposite and actually start joining the conversation. So the time zone piece for us has been more around changing the communication style and And again, sometimes you do need to meet and try to kind of either the US side makes the exception or the Europe side makes the exception to kind of keep balancing it out so that we get some face-to-face communication.
Yeah. Yeah, the part about overhearing people, I think, is very interesting. I think there's a strong movement online where people say, well, you know, you want to reduce chatter, you want to reduce notifications and things coming in all the time. And I understand that movement, and I think I agree with partially with it. But part of me also feels like exactly what you said, you should also be able to manage yourself and say, well, I'm tuning this out. Like, I'm putting my noise canceling headphones on in the office. I think the same goes, like, even in Slack, where you say, like, I'm going to mute this channel. I'm just going to turn off Slack for an hour, you know, or two, or a whole day if you want to get work done. And I think that there's still a bit of education necessary for people to learn to, like, walk away digitally. You know, I can be behind my computer, but, like, tune out all the different signals so I can actually focus on work. One of the things that we see internal team members do a lot, for example, is, like, block time in their calendar that says deep work, and they basically say, well, I do not disturb me here, or I will not be responding because I'm actually doing deep work in this time.
Nice. There is a book with that title. Are you having the team read it, or did they just come up with it? It's literally called deep work.
Yeah, I've heard about it, but no people just call it that.
The whole concept of, like, trying to work without distractions so you can truly go deep into it, but it's a whole book around it. So
yeah, maybe we have a learning budget of $1,000 a year. So I think I'm sure a bunch of people will have read and might be reading those books. Yeah. Given that, you know, you're at the forefront of, like, recruiting and hiring, what is it going to look like over the next few years? What is going to change at employers in the way that they recruit and hire people?
Yeah. So it's a great question. I think there's multiple things that are changing, actually. Like, one of the first things that's changing is how people evaluate talent acquisition departments, because unfortunately, talent acquisition departments historically have been evaluated based on costs, like time to hire, cost of hire, right? Like, it's all around how do we make hires cheaper, faster, which is a terrible metric to think about, but, like, it's because it's easier to measure, and people just have defaulted to that as a metric, which inevitably leads to worse hires, because if that's what you're optimizing for, yes, we'll get it done cheaper, but we'll also get not the talent that we might have wanted to get in. I think we're starting to realize that, like, you get what you measure, right? And starting to measure the impact of the new hires on the company, right? Because the talent acquisition department measures, like, builds the entire company, right? Like, all the people that are going to be working there over the next few years are going to be brought in by the talent acquisition department, and their impact is the people that they've brought in and the impact that those people have made. Now, that's difficult to measure, and that's why people have, even those who realize, have been hiding from it. But it's not impossible, right? Because great hires do make an impact within their first few months. So it's not actually that far removed from being able to, like, evaluate talent acquisition based on this. And it's going to have a transformative effect, right? Because again, if you look at sales is measured by revenue brought in, right? Sure, cost is a piece of it, but it's a secondary piece is the revenue brought in. And that's why sales always gets massive budgets, gets a lot of attention and a lot of tools that support it. I think talent acquisition is going to start seeing the same revolution, because people are realizing you get what you measure. So you've got to be measuring the right things to truly get the outcomes.
And so how do you measure impact?
I mean, there's multiple ways to do it. One is to just to look at, most companies do some form of performance reviews. It could be once a year. It could be every 6 months. This makes the case for doing at least a half a cycle at a 6 months point, so that you can have a more frequent feedback. But then again, most talent acquisition departments are not, like, you know, being built brand new. So you usually already have the data today, right? And all you've got to do is trace it back. Like, how did we bring this person in? Was it the recruiting team? What channel did they find it in, right? So, like, you take some of your best performers and you do work backwards and say, how did we find this person? How can we do more of the same? Is this a recruiter who's just really great at figuring out who is going to be a strong fit at the company? Is it a channel that we're using? Is it a tool that we're using? So you can do this backwards analysis at any given moment and find places. Sure, you want to make the cycle shorter so you can iterate on it faster, but the fact that the cycle can't be too short is not a reason to say, okay, we're just going to focus on reducing cost instead of optimizing for impact.
That's awesome. Thanks so much for being on.
Of course.